Good morning. This is Mark Steiner. Just a reminder that we are listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. It's a pleasure this hour to introduce our guest, who was on the show a long time ago, 1995, when she came through town. She's back again. She has won a 2 Nebula Awards. She's won 2 Hugo Awards. She's a MacArthur Genius Fellow. She has written some of my favorite books on the planet, like Kindred in its 25th anniversary edition, Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Towers. She's written just in the incredible short stories, which we'll talk about it today as well. And I want to welcome Octavia Butler to Baltimore, back to Baltimore, and to the show. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
That's interesting. I was going to start off with this, that we did a show, I think, last spring with Gregory Hampton and Cherie Thomas and Nalo Hopkins, Stephen Barnes, and Sam Delaney when we were looking at African-American science fiction writers.
Mm-hmm.
And they all talked about you as their godmother and their...
not Samuel R. Delaney. He was one of my teachers.
But I thought of you in some ways that you and Ursula K. Le Guin really is kind of the grand dames of sci-fi writing in this country, and you both...
Oh, I don't really qualify there.
I don't think so.
There were a lot of women before me. Yeah. I don't know if there were any black women, except I do know one woman who was married to a white writer, and she would work on his fiction with him. This was Chris Neville and his wife Lil Neville, and she never took credit. But she's the only one I know of, a black woman writer who was writing science fiction before I was and getting it published. And unfortunately, her name's not on anything.
That's too bad. Mm. And I don't think I've read his work at all. But
Betty Ann, I think, is his best-known story. And he wrote that into a novel later on. He's been dead for a while now.
Your short stories, and I was rereading a bunch of them last night, and I forget when they're all on my desk upstairs, but the Blood Child stories and the stories in
the stories in the book called Blood Child. Yes.
Mm-hmm. There was the one that, and I'm trying to remember the name of the story now. It's the story about the woman who was in a world in California after a disease had attacked and no one could speak.
Yes, Speech Sounds.
Speech Sounds.
That was my first Hugo.
That was right, exactly. Mm-hmm. To me, that was an amazing kind of story. I mean, this woman who lived in this world with the chaos that kind of taken and reigned over the planet.
It was as though everybody had some kind of stroke that affected their ability to communicate. Some could speak but couldn't read. Some couldn't do much of anything, gesture. All sorts of things gone wrong with their ability to communicate. I came up with that story, and I don't know, do you want me to talk about this?
Sure. Yeah.
I came up with that story because I had a friend who was dying of cancer, and I used to go to visit her every week on, I don't drive, so I would go on the bus. And she lived quite a distance from me. And every week I'm riding buses that are just loaded with people who are getting on each other's nerves because there are too many of them. And a couple of guys got into a fight mm-hmm. on the bus. And they didn't get into a fight because of anything somebody said. They got into a fight because one didn't like the way the other was looking at him. And it was totally, I mean, here are two beings, intelligent, able to communicate, failing miserably at communication. So I began the book on a bus with two guys getting into a fight because one doesn't like mm-hmm. the way the other is looking at him.
It seems to me that in some ways that short story for me, it ties into a lot of other things that you've written, in that there's this element of... darkness and fear about existence in some ways. It comes through your book, but always the way human beings kind of have to survive in the middle of that and what they do to survive.
I used to think that I was a pessimist
mm-hmm.
because I seemed always to be seeing the bad side of things. And then I realized that with all of my fiction, there was hope.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have pessimistic endings. I had hopeful endings. Not everyone who's reviewed me has noticed this, because I have been criticized for my pessimism. But apparently, I'm a much more hopeful person than I realized. I'm glad, really. I mean, it makes life a little bit better to realize that I don't think that we're all just going down and doing our worst.
But you do kind of see this dark side that in a sense
can't help it.
That there, in some sense, that mercy is a myth, and that you have to kind of walk through this thing and find
mercy is not a myth. It just isn't as commonplace as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the difference between being a pessimist and being hopeful. I'm not exactly an optimist. I mean, I don't think that we're bound to come to good ends because we seem so insistent on not doing that. But on the other hand, there are people who surprise you with their kindness or with justice where you didn't expect it. That kind of thing mm-hmm. is fascinating.
And how much of what happens to you during the in your life kind of then begins to fuel what you have to end up writing about?
Oh, everything in my life is liable to wind up in my writing. When I was living in Pasadena, California, which is my hometown, I got picked up by the police for passing counterfeit money. No, I wasn't.
You really got picked up by the police for this?
Well, I was paying for my groceries with a $100 bill, and the people at the store decided it must be counterfeit, so they called the police, and I wound up with getting a free ride to the police department.
Oh my God!
Really, really humiliating, especially in your hometown, which isn't all that big. You know, somebody's liable to drive by.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I knew she wasn't what she pretended to be. Oh my goodness! And I mean, that was just so embarrassing that I had to ask myself the next day, what can you possibly make of this piece of foolishness? You tell people that writers use everything that happens to them. How can you use this? And I wound up using it as the key to something that I was trying to do in Parable of the Talents. I needed to write scenes in which my character was in a kind of concentration camp where she was being treated mindlessly badly.
Mm-hmm.
They were not focusing on her. They didn't care who she was. I needed to, the connection, by the way, is powerlessness and the idea that things can happen to you for no good reason and you have to somehow deal with them. My character is put into this situation and she understands that it's happening for political reasons, but there isn't anything she can do except try to survive it and try to help her people survive it. It's not, by the way, an actual World War II concentration camp. Mm-hmm. It's a futuristic thing. Actually, she survives it by putting up with it until her captors put themselves in a bad situation and she's able to do something. But that terrible feeling of powerlessness and of recognizing that no matter how well you behave, no matter how much you do what you think of as your duty, someone can come with just a few words and ruin your life. What if they had decided that I really was passing counterfeit money?
I suppose that $100 bill you had been actually a counterfeit bill that you'd gotten someplace innocently.
Well, then I would have to talk to my mother because she was the one who tucked it into a Christmas card, you know?
Right.
My mother and I had this idea that we should help each other. Now, I was past needing her help,
mm-hmm.
but it was a habit with her. She was an old lady, and I felt I had better be helping her. So I would try to calculate how much she was going to give me that I didn't want her to give me, and try to give her at least twice that much. And she had tucked this $100 bill into the Christmas card that she sent to me. And that's why I had it.
That's very funny. So it's a good thing it wasn't really counted.
Only the fact that the police let me go made it funny.
Right.
Otherwise, that little line between comedy and tragedy.
Because the moment itself was terrifying.
Goodness.
You're in the back of the car, handcuffed, taken to it.
No, I was. They didn't handcuff me, thank goodness. I think they realized it was a totally ridiculous situation. I had recognized that the people at the store were lying to me. They were saying, "Oh, we've got to get changed, then we'll be right with you." And what they were doing was they had called the police and they were waiting for the police to come. And I got angry and took my money back. It was lying on the counter between the manager and the clerk. And I took it back and left the store. And just to make a silly situation even more ridiculous, I had to come back in because I had bought a roll of breath mints and put them in my purse after the guy checked them through. And I had to come back and return those because I didn't want to be arrested
for stealing a roll of breath mints,
for heaven's sake. So I went out, and I went to catch my bus. I had walked up to the store. It was a store that was quite a distance from where I lived because I wanted to make it part of my morning walk. And I was going to take the bus home anyway with my groceries. And I went to the bus stop, and along came a member of the Pasadena Police Department. And he explained to me that I had to give him the money, which upset me quite a bit because it was my money, and I was afraid, since it was cash, that I might never see it again. And while we're standing there arguing, without my realizing it, we were surrounded by cars and motorcycles of cops just all around me. And I looked up and I realized, whoa, this is getting very nasty and serious, and I think I better shut up.
My God. Well, I'm glad you got through that one to write some more stories, at least out of that.
But that's what I mean, you know, some little ridiculous thing can happen and your whole life can change.
It's the vagaries of existence, mm-hmm. and you have to deal with whatever comes your way.
That's right.
And as your characters do.
Mm-hmm.
I read a piece about you being interviewed when you talked about your growing up as a child, and I found that fascinating because I think that we sometimes spend the shortest amount of our time on this planet as children and spend the rest of our time dealing with or being affected by our childhood.
We writers get to go on being children for a lot longer. Yes.
You're lucky. You're very lucky. But it was interesting how you grew up in California, Pasadena.
Mm-hmm.
Your father died early. He was a shoeshine person, and your mother was a domestic.
Mm-hmm.
And this world, though, molded you in terms of your view of the world. You talked about being the tallest kid in your class. And
mm-hmm. The presumption was that I'd flunked.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always fun. You know, poor thing. Poor thing.
She must be a dummy.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was very, very shy. So I would watch and notice and not say anything because it was just too embarrassing to say anything. But you can't help noticing. So it was an interesting time to grow up. I remember my best friend in college told me later, after we'd gotten to be friends, you know, I thought you were mentally retarded. Why? Well, I saw you standing outside of class, and your face was just very slack. I was probably on another world. I did a lot of daydreaming, and you looked like maybe there was something wrong with you. And I said, we're in college. How many mentally retarded people do you know who are in college? And,
That's great. Where'd you go to college, by the way?
I went to PCC, Pasadena City College, and then I went to Cal State LA.
Which is where you studied your first science fiction writing?
Oh, goodness, no. No. No, my college was not helpful to me in that way. As a matter of fact, it was more along the lines of, how can I put this? Science fiction was not exactly literary enough to be of interest to them. I had one teacher ask me, can't you write anything normal? And I write to get away from the normal because the normal is usually pretty tedious.
And we'll be right back with Octavia Butler. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. My guest this hour is Octavia Butler. I've written books like Kindred and Lilith's Brood, which I'm in the middle of now, and many other incredible books. Have won the Hugo Award, the Nebula Awards. She was a MacArthur Award winner, and she joins us now here, so you can join us as well as you like. We were talking a bit during the break about Kindred, and I said that I read it some 20-odd years ago, a little after it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a book that grabbed me so deeply that I kind of read it twice. Read it the first time, and then I read it again immediately afterwards just to go back and kind of remember the same things were in it. And I think then it probably hit me, as we were talking about earlier, because my wife then was African American, so there were very few books that were written with mm-hmm. a white man marrying a black woman. You didn't see that very often mm-hmm. in books.
Yeah, you tended to see it in real life.
Right, but not a book.
I could see it in my family, right?
Right.
So, sure. I guess it was it interested me because it added a level of difficulty to what she was going through. If her husband had been black, there would not have been this extra level of tension. And also, when they both went back in time together, I don't know how many of your listeners know, but Kindred is the story of a modern-day black woman who goes back in time to the antebellum South and then who has to struggle to survive slavery. Now, at one point, she and her husband, she's going back, not voluntarily, she's being pulled back, and her husband grabs her, and he winds up going along with her.
Because she goes back and forth in time,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. And it is difficult for him, even when he's there, to see things as she's seeing them, but he's at least able to protect her a little bit during the time when he's with her.
And it to me, one of the interesting things we were talking about, somebody very close to me had had a historical familial relationship that was similar to the book, raised the complexities the book raised, which was the fact that being the descendant, partially descendant of an Octoroon slave and a slave master, and who had then run off to the mountains after the end of the Civil War and actually fell in love and married and had seven daughters. And when you read stories about what happens to between black and white and sexuality and this world and what your character went through in Kindred, and one of the things that I got from this I'd like to talk a bit about is the complexity of that and how it's easy for, I think, people in one historical period to make scathing judgments about another without having to think about what it must have been to walk through that.
I think really it's because they are not empathizing. They're not even able to empathize with the experiences of people who have had to go through something like this. I think the reason that I felt better able to empathize was because my mother's relatives were from southern Louisiana, and their experience, even though much time had passed, their experience was not that different than the experience, say, of newly freed slaves. My grandmother did all sorts of horrible jobs as a younger woman. She got married when she was 12 in order to get away from people who were kind of acting as foster parents. They were relatives, distant relatives. Her mother died giving birth to her. But they didn't want another mouth to feed. So they beat her and treated her rather badly. And she married at age 12 and to a man in his mid-40s. This meant that she had a lot of children before she became a young widow.
Wow.
So she worked unbelievably hard. And some of the things she was doing as a young woman who was pregnant pretty much all the time, they didn't all live, but she used to do laundry for pay. She chopped cane. She'd come in from chopping cane and do some laundry in these big pots that they used to use. And she eventually was doing house cleaning. She did, and you say, I say house cleaning, and you don't realize how hard that was until you look back at all the things that machines do now that people had to do then, and just how incredibly hard it would be on a woman who is usually pregnant or nursing. I don't know if she was ever both, but I mean, she was usually one or the other, and who had a lot of children of her own to look after. And her husband. And meanwhile, she's having to work this hard. It's amazing she lived as long as she did.
You knew her?
She died when I was 10. She was not really that old. She was in her early 60s. We aren't quite sure when she was born, sometime in the late 1890s. And she pretty much worked herself to death. The woman was always working.
Did she ever live out in California? Did she stayed in Louisiana?
Yeah. Oh, no. She's the one who brought the family to California when she became a widow at just about the time the Depression began to get rolling. And she had to find someplace where she could earn enough to feed her family.
Yeah, L.A. was a strange magnet for black folks in Louisiana and Texas, it seems. That was a place that people migrated to.
A lot of them went to Chicago. I had an uncle who went to Chicago and unhappily died as a result of the weather. But most of the family went to L.A., and it enabled my younger aunts and uncles to get an education. My mother only had the 3 years, but, and well, this there's a little sexism here, too, because her older brother, everybody kind of worked to keep him in school. But meanwhile, the next youngest was my mother, and she had to drop out and work and be one of those working to keep him in school. And unhappily, he was the one who died so young in Chicago, trying to live there and work there on a really inadequate wardrobe. So his leg froze, and they took it off, and he got gangrene and died.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was nasty.
All this is fuel for your mind and your work.
It is, yeah. I mean, it doesn't necessarily come into the work as it is, but it comes into the work because it's part of me.
And there's no accident that so many of your characters and people whose stories the books are worked through are very strong Black women.
Oh, yes.
And that's
with a grandmother like mine and a mother, sure. And the fact that I did have uncles, but I didn't have any father figure around. So I really kind of learned how to be a person from these two women. And interesting education.
And they live and breathe here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
You're listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show Archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me @MarkSteiner. Good morning, this is Mark Steiner. Just a reminder that we are listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show Archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me @MarkSteiner.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. My guest this hour is Octavia Butler. You can actually put your headphones off for just a minute. I think we have one or two callers come in. We'll get them on the air with us. Dwight in Greenmount West, you're on the air.
Yes, I was introduced to Octavia Butler through Wild Seed.
Oh, yeah.
And my question is, I think the story is a great love story. That's how I interpret it.
Thank you.
Question is, with the new technology you have today, has anyone approached you about maybe doing that as a movie?
I have been approached. There is a problem with Wild Seed. It's part of a series. Something to do with the way Hollywood works. If you buy the right to one part of a series, you're getting the right to the whole series. And that means costs more money. So Wild Seed has not really been attempted. There's usually someone optioning Kindred. There is right now. So it's maybe or maybe not going to get made. The people who have it now had actually gotten to the point of having a script and hiring some actors. But I don't know what happened in all that. They're still trying.
Yeah, I'm always amazed that your books have not been made into film. I mean, they seem so... Because a good writer, when you sit and read stories like yours... It's like a moving picture in your mind. You can see the tentacles coming off the character, and you know what I'm saying. I mean, you can visualize these people. You can see the situation they're in, and they're so vivid.
Thank you. That's really nice to hear, because I think part of what you're saying. I mean, I understand, but part of what you're saying is that it's visual.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's my least effective way of perceiving. I tend to write without the visual and then go back and put it in because I recognize that I've left it out.
And so what comes first for you when you write?
I hear things. I hear a kind of radio version of the story. A couple of years ago, someone did Kindred and someone else did the short story Bloodchild as radio programs.
Really?
And the short story in particular, because it was so short, it was easier for them to get just about all of it in. They did a really good job.
Where was that?
Where
did they do that?
In L.A. But it came out over some of the NPR stations.
I'm sorry, I missed that. We'll have to go hunt for that one.
Yeah, I think you can actually find it online.
I told you, I'm in the middle now of what I have not read, which is Lilith's Blood, and...
Lilith's Brood.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. And I was just kind of didn't finish before we got in the air here, but it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And it
It's interesting that one of the things that that comes through this and some other works is this notion that you have of one of the problems with the human species, as we grew, is the question of hierarchy.
Well, that we have these characteristics, these two characteristics that are fine separately but are dangerous together, are explosive together. One of them is intelligence, and the other is hierarchical behavior.
Talk a bit about them, because that's, I mean, that when I hit that in the book and started reading some other essays you've written when you did for the racism conference and then saw some things that people talked to you about in terms of hierarchy, I mean, that kind of... first thing that came to my head was politically was kind of anarchism, the anarchic kind of view of life, what a hierarchy does. Not saying that's what you're doing.
Okay.
But just that's the first thing that hit me. Mm-hmm. But then this idea about how hierarchy works to our disadvantage and how you observe that being a disadvantage for the human beings.
It's actually, well, it's something that exists. I'm not talking about any formal hierarchy, but just the informal one-upsmanship that goes on. In everything, algae exhibits hierarchical tendencies. I remember getting this off one of the NPR Nature type series, not necessarily the program Nature, but a series like that. The idea that among certain algae, the method of reproduction is cell division, cloning oneself. So you have two clones of algae on a rock. And they grow, taking up the available space until they meet. And they don't meet and say, oh, excuse me, and start going around the other side of the rock. They meet, and one poisons the other. Whichever one has the stronger poison, poisons the other. And human beings do this. And this is why I say the characteristic works fine as long as you don't mix it with intelligence. Because when you mix it with intelligence, it's very easy for us to one-up ourselves to death. And that's what happens at the beginning of Lilith's Brood. We're looking at humanity after this, after the destruction. And we're looking at the remnants, the people who are left. And they're kind of being reassembled by an alien species who has its own agenda and who are xenophilic. I when I began working on the first book, Dawn, I looked up the word xenophilic because I was sure it must exist. I hadn't seen it, but It obviously should exist. And I couldn't find it. And this really surprised me. You can find it now. But I was looking in my old dictionaries, which were, 1960s vintage. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't there. And I thought, my goodness, that says something about America, I guess, back in the 50s when these dictionaries were being written. Xenophobic was there, a fear of strangers. Xenomaniac was there, so an unnatural liking of strangers. But xenophilic, a love of or an interest in strangers, wasn't there. The only place I found it at that time when I was looking for it before I got going on the books was in the OED. I went to the library, looked in the OED. There it was. I felt better.
It was actually
Yes, it did exist.
You didn't have to make it up.
Right.
But it's interesting these characters are xenophilic. I mean, they just... I don't want to know too much about this book because I want to get deeper into it to find out for myself. But I was thinking as reading this and then in looking at Kindred... Very different books, but for somebody to write a book that talks deeply about different issues, whether it's the essence of and the questions that may evolve out of slavery and the complexities of human relationships that can evolve out of that condition, not the simplistic way most people want to look at things in black and white, and no pun intended, or in this when you talk a great deal about genetic structure and who we are as human beings and how the play of our world and the play of our bodies work with each other to create our beings. I mean, what do you do to... Are these things that have just played in your head for a long time, or do you also end up then going and reading a great deal to think about what's behind it?
Pardon me. Sometimes if something bothers me enough, stays with me enough, I need to write about it. And in cases like Lilith's Brood, those three novels, in cases like Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, these were news items that just bothered me enough so that I couldn't help myself. And not just one news item, mm-hmm. but several of them. And, for instance, in the Lilith's Brood trilogy, I thought about things like this captive breeding programs, the captive breeding programs that we have, where we destroy a species right down to the last few, and then we torture those last few in the hope of bringing the species back. Mm-hmm. It's kind of horrible, really, but... It's at some point, you know, it's either that or let the species be completely extinct. Or the idea that I don't even know whether I should talk about this, but I was kind of inspired by Ronald Reagan.
Uh-huh.
In a not a good way. you notice with these, I was working on them during the, I guess, 1980, the early 80s.
The early Reagan era.
Uh-huh. And I was bothered by the fact that there were people during that era who thought that nuclear war was not only doable, but desirable. There were people who thought it would be easy to survive a nuclear war. There was this one guy who thought you should just, you know, have everybody dig a hole and put a door over it and throw some dirt on the door. This was somebody who actually worked for Reagan. And I was hearing more and more of the most awful nonsense, dangerous nonsense, because the people who were saying it were in high position. And I thought, you know, there's got to be something wrong with us as a species if we're believing this nonsense. And that was when I came up with the conflict, you know, between the two characteristics.
We'll be right back with Octavia Butler. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. My guest this hour is one of America's great science fiction writers, Octavia Butler. And she's here in Baltimore for a lecture she's going to be giving and with us for this hour. And Octavia, let me read this email that came in. And I see the email address, don't know the name, but that's fine. We'll just read it. As an African-American woman who was an avid reader and accused of being fey, I just want to thank Ms. Butler for her works of genius. In her work, I've discovered some of the most intriguing characters and portraits that reach forward to possible humanity and explore human frailty. Her characters are full of depth and intelligence and require readers to expand their notions of what is usual and customary. I've read everything she has ever written, and my only question is, what's next?
Thank you so much. She may not have read everything that I've written, by the way. There's a lot of stuff here. There are a couple of stories online that a lot of people missed just because they were published online. They are on sci-fi.com in the archives, and they are The Book of Martha and Amnesty.
Oh, I'll have to look. I haven't read those.
Two short stories. So... maybe that'll hold her until my next novel comes out. Actually, my next novel has nothing to do with anything I've ever written. It's a vampire story, which embarrasses me slightly. But
why?
Hey, well, because it's I usually am responding to the news or history or whatever, and all of a sudden, every time I tried to do that, I just got very tired and depressed. So I thought it's time to write a total fantasy. So I'm writing a vampire story.
Now, I heard that in an interview once that you did in 2001 that you were in the middle of writing this fantasy book when 2001 hit, and it changed something in you about writing that book at that moment. Did I read that
no,
right?
No. No, that might have been someone else, but no, not me.
I thought I was reading that in one of the NPR interviews you had done earlier.
No, the only thing I can think of that involved a sudden change, maybe not that sudden, but when I was writing Parable of the Talents, I was going along and it wasn't going that well, but it was moving. And my problem was I didn't want to entangle my character in this horrible prison business that I mentioned earlier. My mother passed away. Mm. She had a stroke, and then 3 weeks later she died. And this meant that for a while I wasn't writing anything at all. And much later, when I got back into writing, I discovered that the novel had become a mother-daughter story. And it had just happened. It's not something that I sat down and decided or plotted or whatever. The only writing I had done during that period was some journal writing that was just personal. But all of a sudden, here I was with this mother-daughter story. And what's more, the daughter was rather resentful of the mother. And it took me a while to realize that part of that was, I guess I was kind of mad at my mother for dying,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't make any sense, but then some human feelings don't make any sense.
That makes sense. I think that happens to a lot of people. How could you leave now? Where did you go?
Oh, boy. But anyway, that's the only thing that happened in any way suddenly like that. Now, as a matter of fact, I was one of the ones running around saying, it's just a number. You know, somebody decided to begin at a certain point and carry on. And the fact that all of a sudden it's 2000 or 2001 doesn't really make any difference.
I have another email here. Let's see what someone else has written to us. Robert writes in, I think Miss Butler's worldview is a realistic one and not a pessimistic one. You expect people to behave badly and are surprised when they do something good.
Well, people can teach me. I mean, I don't expect bad behavior, but sometimes good behavior surprises me just because I've been without it for a while. And also, sometimes you hear things that are wrong. The first time I went to New York from California in 1976, I had just gotten my first novel published, and I just decided to take my first vacation. And since I didn't get paid very much for the novel, my vacation was a Greyhound Ameripass and rooms at various Y's.
Mm-hmm.
And I traveled across the country to New York, and I'd always heard these things about New Yorkers. They're brusque, they're rude, they're mean, blah, blah, blah. And the first thing that happened to me when I was in New York was I lost, if you're traveling Greyhound, you don't expect there to be linens in the room, towels and all this. You carry your stuff.
Right.
I lost my towel. And I went back to the bathroom where I'd lost it and asked the woman who was maintaining the bathroom. And this, by the way, was at the main bus station in New York, which has an especially bad reputation.
Yes.
And she said, no, I don't know anything about it. And then she's kind of brusque. And then she turned back and she said, are you okay? You know, can you get another one? And I had the feeling that she might actually have either sent me someplace where I could get help,
mm-hmm.
or helped me herself. I mean, it wasn't a casual question. And, yeah, I was okay. You know, it was a good thing that I was at least able to take care of little losses like that. But it was like, oh, this is New York, too. You know, just a nice woman.
Well, your characters, though, all have this humanity in them, at least that I can find. I mean, there's a deep humanity in all of them, and it's whether it's in Kindred having to kind of rescue constantly a white ancestor.
That,
you know,
she sort of has to, though.
Well, yeah, but I mean, she does it, though. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's something that she's impelled to do it.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I had to figure out how I could get that going and make it reasonable for her. And the way I did it was to have her meet him first when he's a child. So who could leave a child to drown?
Right.
I mean, if she could do something about it. Who could find a child who's fallen out of a tree and broken his leg?
And not do something.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Or whose room is on fire.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you meet him first as this rather trouble-prone kid, you can get to like him. And then later he grows up and you don't like him so much, but he's a person. You know, he's not just the bad guy. He's a person.
Full of all that person's complexities, mm-hmm. no matter mm-hmm. slave master or not.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things some people would expect of a book like that is, and books like that, or books about the Holocaust or anything else, is that is that you why didn't you stand up and slay him? Why didn't you, you know, I mean...
My editor was the first to ask me that question, And I said, well, of course, there is a built-in reason she's going to be wiping out her own family if she does
that. She might die herself if she kills him,
might not ever have been born. I mean, that's the kind of dilemma that all time travel stories are afflicted with. But the other, I said to my editor, it shouldn't be that easy to kill a person that you know and have a relationship with. I mean, maybe you don't like them, but you've known them for a while. So it really, if it is that easy to kill them, it shouldn't be.
I just put your headphones on one more time. We have another caller here to join our conversation. Frank in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, Frank.
Good morning.
I love the book Kindred, but when I first read it, I had a question about how easy it was for her to fall into that slave role. It just seemed to me the way it was written that it just didn't take much for her to be a subservient or to be a slave.
It took a really terrible beating is what it took. And she probably didn't want another, although she got another. What she had to do was act a role. If she didn't act that role, she would have died for it. It's easy to imagine that you would be bold and strong and refuse to behave that way. And maybe you would, but you would simply be killed.
That's one way to look at it, huh?
It's the truth.
Frank, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The just for a second with Kindred, then we'll come back to something else. The idea that this woman in this book had to go through this incredible pain to even define herself in her own century. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, how it even redefines the relationship between...
herself and her husband?
Yes.
Yes.
Because of that complexity when he goes back.
Mm-hmm. A number of teachers have told me that they have assigned students to write a follow-up chapter.
Uh-huh.
What happens in that relationship, you know? It's one way of seeing what they've seen in the book. Interesting assignment.
It is an interesting assignment. Mm-hmm. I mean, the white and black kind of love, sex, power relationship that exists.
Yeah, in this country.
In this country, period.
Yeah.
There was a great book that was written years ago. I can't remember the name of the author, but I think it was called Sex and Race, and it was about...
Calvin Hurton.
Yes, the one that each chapter, white
he
woman, black woman.
He was a friend
woman.
Of mine, yes.
It was an incredible book. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the most powerful books on that subject I think I've ever read. Mm-hmm. But in many ways, I felt that some of that was in here. Where is it? In here. Mm-hmm. Kindred.
Uh-huh.
Because those are the questions that I think that are so volatile for this country to wrestle with.
Yeah, and I think sometimes... it's almost, I can understand people, black people who left the country, especially when times were a lot harder, but to be able to just kind of take off this heavy coat of all the assumptions that people made about you because you were black, or, for instance, if you were a black man, you know, you were supposed to be hypersexual and all the nonsense. If you were a black woman, you were supposed to be so lascivious you couldn't be raped, which made for a lot of rape.
Right. Justifying the rape.
And the other nonsense in this country, that it was just such a relief to shed that and not carry that around. I can remember making a decision myself, not with regard to sex so much as just the whole racial issue in this country, when I was taking night classes out at UCLA. This was some not-for-credit stuff I did just to help my writing. And one of the teachers was Theodore Sturgeon, who was a very well-known science fiction writer at the time, and who wrote really well. A lot of science fiction writers got away with writing badly, and he wasn't one of them, so...
Nor would he allow you, I guess, right?
Yeah, I wanted to learn from him. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I remember coming out of the class... and it being a night class, and I had to take the bus. I had to walk a long way to get the bus that I needed. And just crying because I felt that I had all this stuff to prove, and realizing that it was not a burden that interested me, that if I had to prove that if everything I was doing was to prove that I was human, that meant that I was handicapping myself, that I was handicapped by my culture, and that I was accepting the handicap, and that I was going to write what I wanted to write. I got a lot of static from Black people. Why are you writing science fiction? Mm-hmm. This was a while back. There are a lot more Black people reading science fiction now and using it themselves, writing it themselves to say things that they have to say. But during the 60s and the early 70s, why are you writing science fiction? It's not really part of the struggle. You should be doing something to help the struggle. And I what I was getting from a lot of the students in Sturgeon's class, not deliberately, was that they had had really good educations. They had read stuff I'd never heard of, mm-hmm. and I hadn't. So on the one hand, maybe I'm not good enough, and on the other hand, maybe I shouldn't be doing this because it's not the right thing for me as a Black person to do. So I had to come up with the idea myself. I have to decide what I'm going to do, because if I'm trying to do something that somebody else thinks I should be doing, I won't function. I mean, I will waste my life.
Right.
Trying to prove something to somebody else instead of being the best me that I can.
And I think the beauty of it all, too, is what you've married in your work. I mean, in some senses, the science and the mysticism and the history.
I don't think you'll find too much mysticism.
Maybe that's the wrong word. But what I mean is characters who kind of found new religions and think about life in a different way.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, mysticism was the wrong word. It was mm-hmm. more kind of spirituality and looking at life in that sense.
Uh-huh.
That's something that I think a lot of people try to get done, mm-hmm. but it's very difficult to do.
Yeah, I find that if I go with the ideas that won't let me alone, I will write things that matter not only to me but to other people.
This has been a fascinating hour. I really appreciate you taking the time and doing this today.
Thank you.
For joining us. And I encourage you all to pick up a book. And Kindred, Lilith's Brood, Parable of the Sower, and many others you can find. Go to this website at sci-fi.com, which I'm going to do to try the ones that many of us have never read, which is the Book of Martha and Amnesty, mm-hmm. two short
Just
stories.
Just go to archives and you can find them.
Octavia Butler, thanks so much again. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
And keep writing for us.
Okay.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.